Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
What tribes do you belong to? For British Member of Parliament David Lammy, there are many. He has Guyanese roots. He feels connected to the United Kingdom and, as a politician, to his party, the Labour Party. But in a new book, he says sorting ourselves into groups can also be problematic. It's called Tribes, How Our Need to Belong Can Make or Break Society. And David Lammy joins us once again from London. Welcome back. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Really pleased.
Well, and let's go to where you begin this book, which is that you got your DNA tested. What did you find out?
Well, my parents are from Guyana, at the top of South America, the bottom of the Caribbean. I've always known, I guess, that my descendants were enslaved people who came from Africa across the Middle Passage, brought by probably the Dutch, but maybe the English, to Guyana. It was a Dutch colony at one point. I took this DNA test, and what it told me was that on my father's paternal line, I went back to Bantu South Africans and Angolans. And on my mother's maternal line, I went back to the Temne tribe in Sierra Leone and Tuaregs in the country of Niger. And I've got a little bit of Scottish in me.
Well, and you said that it gave you something that you had longed for, which was a genetic sense of self. And I wonder, why did you want that so much?
Well, I think, like a lot of African Americans who are listening, like a lot of folk who stem from the Caribbean or Latin America, we are hybrid people. And if you are the descendant of enslaved people, you know, at a certain point, there was a dramatic, traumatic interruption in which your descendants lost their language, lost their culture, lost who they were. And because most of those slaves were captured as really sort of teenagers, that chain and that link back to wherever you came from in Africa was broken. So there is a longing and a belonging that isn't quite there. So it's an intriguing process to take your DNA test if you are the descendant of enslaved people. And that's the journey I went on. And it took me to Niger. And I write about that experience of going to a black Muslim country, spending time with these wonderful black Muslim people, praying with them, eating with them, sitting with them. And I felt a deep connection that I said to them at the end of the ceremony they did for me, that, you know, I will stand up in the House of Commons in London and I will stand taller than I was before I came here, because I have a greater sense of who I am as I stand in that historic place, speaking truth to power.
Well, and how does that connection that you had there compare to the connection you have to Britain, compare to the connection that you have, let's say, to your neighborhood in London, or to the Labour Party, which is the party that you are a member of? How do those tribes compare?
I thought it was important, if I was going to write a book about the new tribalism that is gripping our world, that is making politics deeply partisan, that is meaning that people fall into these rabbit holes and echo chambers, that I needed to explore my tribe. So you're absolutely right. Yes, I'm the descendant of Guyanese people who were formerly Africans. But in the end, I grew up in London and in the city of Peterborough in Middle England. I was very fortunate to go to Harvard Law School. I am a black middle-class man here in the UK. And in getting to what I wanted to write about, it was important to explore my tribes. And I explore those tribes in the book. I talk about what it meant to go to a boarding school in Peterborough. I go back to that city. I speak to people who have strong views about immigration, people who took me into their homes, who fed me, who loved me because I had friends from that city at school who lived in the city, but nevertheless have very different views to me. These are folk in the UK that would be like folk you would meet in the Rust Belt in America that would have voted for Donald Trump and feel very strongly against folk in the city and in Washington. And I spent time with those people and talked about my affection for those folk, even though we had very different views, and how I belong in that city and how that makes me English, and how there are things about me, despite being a Black Briton, you know, things that are quintessentially English, my humour, the food I eat and like, mm-hmm. the things that I grew up with, and indeed my party, the Labour Party, and the traditions that the Labour Party has as a senior British politician. So I explore all of that, and I try to write about these things in a way that's not judgmental, in a way that's trying to listen and to hear and to bridge divides. You know, I'm married to a white middle-class woman. My children are biracial, and I have a large white extended family, some of whom do not hold the same political views as myself. So that's the I'm trying to write in a generous way to arrive at a point where I explore the divisions that we're all living with that seem so powerfully strong in wider society at this time.
Well, and when you talk about some of those things, you see the sort of charming side of tribes. But you also talk a lot in this book about where tribalism becomes a real problem. And I want to go through a couple of those. And let's start with politics, because in your country and in this country, there are some politicians who march in such lockstep with their party that it does seem like, you know, the party is more important than even their own views on things. How did politics become so tribal?
You're absolutely right. We're living in an age of populism. We're living in an age where there has been a deliberate attempts in parts of our politics, in the UK, on the extreme left and the extreme right of politics, to deliberately divide us, to deliberately take people's eye off the ball. The issue of our times is not artificial intelligence or automation or deep inequality across society. The issue of our time is building a Mexican wall, is fighting mm-hmm. with the European Union, is Imran, who just arrived from a Muslim country and wants to take your job. And that stuff is stoked on social media. And indeed, there are even external countries, Russia very famously, manipulating this stuff. Those are the times we're in, deliberately playing to the worst instincts of tribalism mm-hmm. and whole swathes of the population happy to sort of deep dive into this. And it doesn't end in a great place. I mean, you know, the challenges of our time, climate change, a global pandemic, actually require global cooperation. Right. That's the point.
Well, and you talk about tribalism and Islamist extremism in a conversation that you had with a taxi driver who told you about his son who had been radicalized by ISIS. Tell us about that and what you learned from that interaction.
Well, it was a trip that I was in a sort of taxi on the way to Heathrow Airport. And it was just a painful story because, of course, in examining how this had happened, we touched on the loneliness of these young men, sitting in their bedrooms, the internet, what was going on at the local mosque, the ways in which these young men were seduced into this violent extremism that had now had catastrophic effect on their family. And I linked that theme of loneliness to another individual who sent me and five other members of parliament here in the UK a serious death threat. And I went to his trial. And despite the fact that this man had called me the N-word, had hurled abuse, had threatened to kill me, sitting in his trial, I realized that this individual was kind of pathetic and was lonely. He was a lonely, mean racist, able to sort of exact revenge again, be seduced into extremism. This is far-right extremism, the sort of extremism that killed my fellow MP and colleague Joe Cox a few years ago here in the UK. And these same themes coming up that I thought it was important to explore.
People are lonely and they need to belong.
We have an innate need to belong. And I think the other thing that I explore in the book is, of course, the theme of our times, identity politics. Here I am as a black member of parliament, of course, called to defend and speak up for minority black communities here in the UK and globally, to be in solidarity with movements like Black Lives Matter. But at the same time, I also recognize that if race is the start and end of every conversation, then we run the risk of not finding common purpose and a shared humanity.
David Lemme, as you know, we've been going through quite a moment in this country, a movement following the death of George Floyd, and it's forced many to examine the lenses through which we see the world. Do you think that examination can help us better understand each other? In other words, can I ever really understand what life is like in your shoes and vice versa?
Well, look, if you believe in human dignity, if you understand that before the invention of scientific racism, the science that allowed Europeans to go out and colonize and enslave the world, of course there's a common humanity that means that empathy and compassion and whatever the color of our skin, we share so much more in terms of our genetics and our DNA. And I explore that at length in my book, Tribes. But I guess you have to dismantle the architecture that has been years and years in the making. And we're still on that painful journey. And, you know, what's in a way, I'm uplifted by Black Lives Matter because when I look at protests globally, whether in the United States, in Sydney, Australia, or in London, I see black and white young people saying enough is enough. And I see active allies. They may not be black, but they're active. They're using what they perceive to be their privilege to make a difference. And that inspires me. But I also worry, black pain, that gaze that settled on the dying man that was George Floyd is so familiar. And in a sense, whilst the story is so often portrayed as being about black people, in my view, black people have been telling this story that is structural racism for hundreds of years. And the real question is not about blackness, it seems to me. It is a question about whiteness. It is a question about how majority communities finally not just don't just see, but act. And that's the opportunity that we have at the moment, that there is a sense that we have to act. And perhaps it is because of the current incumbent of the White House, the current incumbent of number 10 Downing Street, the current incumbent in Brasilia. It's perhaps because of these individuals that we've reached this critical point.
Well, on the issue of the majority community, many people have been examining their own maybe unconscious bias. And you write in this book that any suggestion of unconscious bias is too uncomfortable to consider as it is interpreted as an allegation of direct, overt, and malevolent racism, that to be implicated in any form of racism is to have your overall moral integrity challenged. Has that made it more difficult, do you think, or will that make it more difficult for white people in these countries to come to terms with what has happened to black people and indigenous people in these countries?
Well, look, I am writing there about white fragility. And I say this married to a white woman, white family members. So I don't, you know, let me be clear about that. But I'm writing about the way in which, almost because of Luther King's call to look past color, can black children and white children sit down together? that there's this assumption, really, that the best state is to be colorblind. And of course, that isn't not what King was talking about. King was getting way beyond that, because being black is real for black people. It has consequences for black people. And so it's not about being colorblind. It's not about individual acts of racism. It's about a system and a structure that is institutionalized, systemized, and is, I don't know, is so debilitating. So the, you know, you have to get past the fragility of, oh my God, that person just implied I was racist or called me racist, or oh my God, what do you mean I've got unconscious bias? And let me tell you something from my point of view, from where I'm sitting here, that's not judgmental. It's me being honest about race. Mm-hmm. I remember when I came to America and I studied at Harvard Law School, and then I got a job in Silicon Valley. And when I went to work as a lawyer in Silicon Valley, it was the first time that I had ever met Native Americans. Mm-hmm. I had all these weird ideas from cowboy films. Deeply, deeply prejudiced tropes about what it meant to be a Native American. I brought that baggage to that law firm. And I needed to be seriously educated about what it meant to be Native American, right? I had to face my prejudices and my assumptions. I had to unlearn that crap that had crawled into my soul, right? And I had to get over my prickliness at being challenged for having prejudicial views, right? And that's work. And I had to do that work. Now, I may have been assisted because I had experienced prejudice, but no man, no black man wants to be called prejudiced and true. So what I'm saying is that was a system that put Native Americans at the bottom of the heap. And in a sense, you have to unlearn that stuff. And it's work. You have to do the work.
What do you think about reparations, whether it be monetary or just a public hearing of sort of the sins of the past, not just for the U.S., but for the United Kingdom as well?
The starting point is truth and reconciliation, as we saw in South Africa. Repairing the damage is about truth. It is about reconciliation. And when I say truth, it means that we're no longer in a society where we question notions like white privilege. We're no longer in a society where we say, look, systemized racism doesn't exist. And then we get to a point where we have to discuss power and reckoning and repairing. And that, to some extent, is obviously financial and involves endowments. I'm really, really pleased that here in the UK, we have universities like Cambridge University, Glasgow University, doing the work to understand their slave history and what they did and why they did it, and then thinking about, well, how do we move on from there?
Let me just finally ask you a couple of questions, and we'll call this a lightning round just to get through a couple of things that you bring up in this book, because you talk about the need for more people to be engaged in politics. Should voting be mandatory?
I actually believe it should be. People died to give us the vote. Yes, let's make it mandatory.
Do you think Brexit will actually happen at the end of this year? Not just on paper as it did a couple months ago, but all the details.
Yes, I think that Britain will be leaving the European Union, and it will be Boris Johnson that's the face of that departure. And that departure will hit the UK economy massively. And it comes at the same time as the post-pandemic economy. So the UK is going to be, in my estimation, in a very, very fragile place in the global community. And it's deeply, deeply worrying. But it is Boris Johnson that has delivered it, and he must be held to account for it.
Do you think it's possible that the UK would re-enter the European Union down the road?
I don't think in my lifetime the debate's been so scarring. But I think there's a reckoning. There's a reckoning for Britain in really coming to terms with you know, not being the country of empire and not being part of the European Union. Now, whether it becomes the 51st state of the United States of America, we will see. But some people think that is the only way that, frankly, this country can survive as we know it going forward. I haven't got a crystal ball. Let's see.
That would be pretty ironic. let me finally ask you.
The War of Independence comes full circle.
Exactly.
Guess who's going to lose out in that arrangement, by the way?
Right.
Because it ain't going to be our brothers and sisters in the States.
Let me finally ask you, just going back to the issue of tribes. Many countries in the world right now are dealing with a rise of the far right, and also many are dealing with a rise of the far left. Where do you see the political winds blowing?
Well, in an age of deep inequality, where we're now going into a recession, depression for many economies, where we have largely unregulated social media, I'm afraid we will see extreme politics. There's no doubt about it. However, I do have a lot of faith in this younger generation who I do think get it. They get climate change. The problem is they're some way from the levers of power. They're still young, mm-hmm. right? Just look at the American election, look at the candidates and look how old they are. So mm-hmm. we're in a bridging point. Let's see what happens in the November elections in the US. But it is a rocky period. We will get through it. And as one old timer said to me, when we do get through it, my God, it's going to make the 1960s look tame.
That is David Lammy, a Labour Party member of the British Parliament. His new book is called Tribes, How Our Need to Belong Can Make or Break Society. David Lammy, it is always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. So pleased to be with you.